March 22nd, 1975, Claremont, Florida. After climbing out of the shower, 32-year-old John Harden looks out the window and notices that his pickup truck is on fire. When John rushes outside to extinguish the flames, he is ambushed by a fatal shotgun blast to the chest, and an extensive investigation fails to turn up any strong suspects or a motive for the crime. Over the next several years, multiple people move into John's former residence and report unexplained paranormal events which make them believe the house is haunted by John's ghost, but the authorities are unable to solve his murder. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to this month's first Halloween-themed episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring a cold case which has an unlikely supernatural connection. The 1975 murder of John Harden. Ever since the inception of this podcast, it's been a tradition for us to count down to Halloween by spending the month of October covering mysteries which either took place on Halloween or had some sort of spooky or paranormal slant to them. This year, I'll be following the same approach I used last Halloween by putting together episodes about unsolved cold cases which are alleged to have ties to supernatural elements, though this may be the result of the spreading of misinformation and sensationalistic details. And today, we're going to start off by exploring a case in which the spirit of an unsolved homicide victim is alleged to have haunted the location they were killed. I first became familiar with this story when it was featured on a special Halloween-themed episode of Unsolved Mysteries that aired in October of 1991 and explored an old Victorian house in Florida which was believed to be haunted. 16 years earlier, the house's previous owner, John Harden, was murdered when an unknown individual set fire to his pickup truck in order to lure him outside and kill him with a fatal shotgun blast. I have to admit that when I learned about this, I kind of wish that Unsolved Mysteries had completely ignored the whole haunted house angle and focused more on the crime itself. It didn't provide all that many details about John Harden's death, but at the same time, I could understand why they explored the idea that his restless spirit had stayed behind to haunt his former residence because he never received justice for his murder. But even if you ignore the whole paranormal angle, this is a very perplexing case, as it does not sound like investigators were able to make much headway with figuring out what happened here. On this episode, we're not going to ignore the supernatural elements of the story, but we are going to share more details about Harden's background and put the primary focus on the circumstances surrounding his murder. As a disclaimer, I should mention that since this is a ghost story, I did run into the issue of finding conflicting information from different sources, and this even includes the spelling of the victim's last name and his age. Most of the sources state that Harden was 32 years old at the time of his death, but they alternate between spelling his last name with an E or an I. I found a picture of John's gravestone, which was issued by the military, since he had once served as an airman second class in the United States Air Force. It lists his birth date as January the 20th, 1942, which would have made him 33 years old when he died, and it spells his last name, H-A-R-D-E-N. You would think that you could trust his gravestone for accuracy, but some sources state that his birth date and the spelling of his surname there are wrong, and Harden should actually be spelled H-A-R-D-I-N. However, many years later, one of John's children passed away, and the spelling of his last name on his gravestone is Harden with an E, so I'm going to assume that's the correct version, and it's the spelling I'll be going with on this episode. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, So if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the unsolved murder of John Harden. Our story begins in 1975 in Claremont, Florida, a small town located in Lake County just west of Orlando, which had a population of around 4,000 people at that time. Our central figure is 32-year-old John Warren Harden, who grew up in Claremont and married his high school sweetheart Rita at the age of 18. The couple would eventually move to Jacksonville and have four children together named Timothy, Lisa, John Jr., and Lori. However, during one afternoon in 1973, John returned home from work and approached Rita in the kitchen, where he proceeded to put his arms around her and tell his wife he loved her. But John then told Rita that he had to go away for a while because he had some problems and needed to get himself together. John then proceeded to move out and leave his family, and even though he implied that he would eventually return, he never did. Instead, John got remarried to a woman named Victoria Mango, who was about 10 years younger than him. They would go on to have a son named John Warren Harden Jr., and decided to move to John's original hometown of Claremont. It turned out that Victoria had inherited an old Victorian house in Claremont, which was located on Osceola Drive and dated all the way back to 1885. Since Victoria had entered into a contract to sell the house, it was decided that she would move in there alongside John and their newborn son. After arriving in Claremont during the summer of 1974, John borrowed his wife's maiden name to open up his own commercial industrial refrigeration business called Mango Refrigeration, which serviced a number of restaurants and local businesses. On the evening of Saturday, March the 22nd, 1975, John received an emergency phone call from a drive-in restaurant in the nearby town of Groveland. The owner desperately needed a part for his chicken fryer, so John climbed into his pickup truck and drove to the restaurant to fix the problem, and he also decided to take along Victoria and John Jr., who was 9 months old by this point. The Hardens returned to the residence at around 10:45 p.m., and John parked his truck in the driveway, which had a turnoff that allowed him to park behind the house. John then went up to the second-floor bathroom to take a shower, but shortly before 11:10 p.m., he emerged from the shower and looked out the window of the adjacent bedroom and noticed that his pickup truck was on fire in the driveway. Now, you'll find differing accounts from differing sources about what happened next, as some older newspaper articles state that John ran out of the house while he was still nude, while some more recent sources claim that he quickly threw on a flannel shirt and some jeans. This clothing is an important detail which I'll get into in a little while, but regardless of which version of this story is correct, we know that John then proceeded to run down the back staircase into the kitchen before he headed out onto the back porch. At some point, John grabbed a fire extinguisher and ran over to the truck to extinguish the flames. Even though Victoria attempted to follow him outside, John yelled at her in the kitchen to go back upstairs and get the baby in case the flames spread and caused the house to catch fire. After Victoria went to grab John Jr., she was heading back downstairs and described hearing a noise which she said sounded like an explosion. Victoria soon exited the house and discovered that her husband was now lying on the ground next to his truck. When Victoria went over to John, she noticed a large wound in his chest, and he faintly said to her, quote, "They shot me." By this point, the Hardens' neighbors had noticed the truck fire and called for help, and they were now arriving at the scene. The police and the fire department soon showed up to extinguish the blaze and tend to John, but even though he was immediately rushed to the hospital, John passed away at around 11:25 p.m. Shortly thereafter, the police found a 20-gauge bolt-action shotgun in some bushes next to the houses back stairs. It seemed apparent that someone had set fire to John's truck in order to lure him out of the residence and hid in the bushes to ambush him by firing a fatal shot into his chest. Victoria had reported hearing a noise which sounded like an explosion, and while it was obviously the shotgun blast, she did not actually witness the murder, and the shooter managed to flee without being seen by anyone. The house was only 2 blocks away from Lake Mineola, which had a boat ramp, so investigators explored the possibility that the killer could have used a boat for their escape. In some of the earliest media accounts, the authorities asked people who were playing tennis or shuffleboard at Claremont's municipal recreation area on the night of the murder to come forward, as it was located near the Hard residence, and these witnesses may have seen or heard something which would be beneficial to the investigation. It turned out that the house's phone lines had been cut, which may have been done by the perpetrator while John and his family were out on a service call. The shotgun had no serial number on it, making it impossible to trace, so at one point, investigators publicly released a photograph of the weapon in the local newspapers. They hoped that someone, possibly the individual who originally sold the weapon to the killer, might recognize the shotgun, but no one ever came forward. Following the murder, Victoria reportedly did not spend another night in the house and soon moved back to Jacksonville with her son. Contemporary news accounts state that Victoria was not very cooperative with the police, though they did acknowledge that this may have been because a small amount of marijuana was found inside the residence. For the next several months, an extensive investigation took place which involved the Claremont Police Department, the Lake County Sheriff's Office, and numerous law enforcement agencies which even extended as far as Atlanta, Georgia. Hundreds of eyewitnesses were interviewed, and while investigators maintained a list of several possible suspects, there was not enough evidence to implicate anyone, and no clear motive for the murder. One possible theory involved John having disagreements with some labor unions from Jacksonville, as he refused to join them, and once told his wife that union members were, quote-unquote, out to get him. Shortly before John's death, his business, Mango Refrigeration, had obtained a couple of profitable contracts which would have taken work away from union members and caused potential friction. Indeed, around the time period of the murder, there were a number of suspicious incidents in the town of Ocoee, located 15 miles away, as there was a union-related bombing of a sand company there, and someone burned 26 company vehicles belonging to a large plumbing company. Investigators also heard rumors that John may have been involved in drug trafficking, though they cannot find any evidence to substantiate these allegations. But curiously, they also learned that for reasons unknown, John apparently introduced himself in some circles as John Mango, using his wife's maiden name, rather than John Harden. In an article about this case published in the November 21, 1980 edition of the Orlando Sentinel, Detective Jerry Blair of the Claremont Police Department claimed that during the original investigation, some people who were known to be friends of Harden would downplay their friendships by telling police they were only acquaintances with him. Blair stated, quote, "The recollections were all vague. 4 or 5 of them were supposed to be together the night before he was killed, but none could remember which ones were with the others," end quote. I should also mention that this same Orlando Sentinel article mentioned that a male jacket had been found at the scene alongside the shotgun, though I've never seen this detail corroborated by any other source. The investigation reached a standstill, but the case would be reopened and garner national attention when it was featured on a special Halloween-themed episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired on October the 30th, 1991. However, the murder itself would not be the focal point of the segment which was produced for the show. You see, in the 16 years since John Harden was killed, multiple people had lived in his former residence on Osceola Drive in Claremont and reported having experienced bizarre incidents of supposed paranormal activity which they could not explain. In March of 1978, a woman named June Ferris moved into the house with her husband and 3 children, and on the day they were unpacking their possessions, they left their boat parked on a trailer in the driveway with the trailer's hitch resting on a wooden stand. The Ferrises claimed that on multiple occasions, the hitch seemed to lift off the stand all by itself before it fell down onto the pavement. Whenever anyone from the family put the hitch back on the stand, they said it would fall off again, and since these incidents often occurred within seconds of each other, it would have been impossible for anyone to sneak up and lift the trailer hitch without the family noticing. Another strange incident would involve one of the Ferris daughters, Robin, whose husband David moved in with the family. One night, Robin and David were sleeping upstairs when they were awakened by the sounds of music boxes. When the couple went downstairs, they noticed that a couple of music boxes in the residence had inexplicably started playing all by themselves. In October of 1985, just a few days before Halloween, another Ferris daughter, Lori, was in the parlor watching TV with her boyfriend Bob when they suddenly heard the back door slam, followed by the sound of heavy footsteps walking into the house. The footsteps seemed to stop at the entrance to the parlor, but when Lori and Bob turned around, no one was there. Bob went to investigate and heard heavy footsteps again and proceeded to follow them to a door, which abruptly slammed shut by itself. For years, the Ferris family never actually saw a ghost in the house, but shortly after the incident with the footsteps, Robin had a strange experience when she was climbing the stairs and said she felt a sudden chill. It wasn't long before she believed that she saw a ghostly figure of what appeared to be a man in his 30s, which popped up right in front of her before it quickly faded away. 3 months later, Bob had his own paranormal experience when he went into the attic and saw what he described as a white vapor-like spirit shaped like a human. It quickly propelled itself in Bob's direction and shot right through his body before it disappeared. Shortly thereafter, Bob decided to go to the local library to do some research on the house, and it was here when he uncovered old newspaper articles about John Harden's murder. While learning this information, caused June Ferris to hearken back to an odd dream she first had back in 1968, 10 years before her family even moved in to Harden's former residence. Back when they still lived in Richmond, Virginia, June said that she started experiencing a dream which involved her waking up in a strange house, walking down a back staircase into the kitchen. She would then walk out the door onto the porch while having a very anxious feeling before she suddenly woke up. June said that she had this same recurring dream numerous times until her family moved to Orlando in 1972. 2 years after that, June was driving through Claremont when she became intrigued by an old Victorian house she saw on Osceola Drive. Since the house was up for sale at the time, June got permission from the realtor for her and one of her friends to go inside and take a tour. June said that she was overtaken by a feeling of deja vu, and when she saw the back staircase, the kitchen, and the porch, she realized that this appeared to be the exact same house from a recurring dream. Of course, John and Victoria Harden would move into this house a short time later, until the Ferrises bought it in 1978. After learning about the circumstances of how John was killed, June realized that the route she walked in her dream down the back staircase, through the kitchen, out onto the porch, was the exact same route John had taken when he noticed his pickup truck was on fire and ran outside the house to be murdered. Since the crime had never been solved, June now wondered if John's restless spirit had remained in the house in hopes that he could use her to attain justice. Indeed, those who saw the ghostly figure thought it bore a resemblance to John, and described him as being dressed in jeans and a flannel shirt, the same clothing which John supposedly wore when he was killed. There were also apparently numerous incidents in which Robin's son Raymond woke up to see the ghost watching over him in his bedroom. Raymond was left so terrified by the experience that Robin said that she yelled at the ghost to stay away from her son, and after that, he never came back. According to John's first wife, Rita, he was an overly protective parent who would often walk into their children's bedrooms to check in on them as they slept, which the Ferrises believed was further evidence that the ghost was him. Well, in 1990, the Ferrises finally decided to move out of the house, and it was purchased by a couple named Ken and Donna Hatley. Well, it wasn't long before the Hatleys started experiencing their own supernatural occurrences, such as unexplained sounds from the upper floors, and visions of what appeared to be the ghostly figure of a man, which caused them to feel a cold rush of wind through their bodies before the apparition disappeared. At one point, the Hatleys held a dinner party in which several guests reported seeing the same vision of a man who appeared to be dressed in jeans and a flannel shirt. Since Ken Hatley was a music producer, he wound up crossing paths with a producer from Unsolved Mysteries when they had a business conversation. After Ken shared his account of the hauntings in his home, the producer felt compelled to do further research into the story and decided that it would make for a good segment to feature on a Halloween-themed episode of the show. When the Unsolved Mysteries production crew showed up at the house to film some reenactments, they claimed that the shoot was plagued by some odd, unexplained events, such as lights flickering on and off, equipment failing, doors opening on their own, and an attic window shattering for no apparent reason. In spite of this, the episode aired as scheduled, but in a sad turn of events, John Harden's oldest child, Timothy Harden, passed away only 4 days later, on November the 3rd, 1991, at the age of 30. The following Halloween, the Orlando Sentinel ran an article about the supposedly haunted house in which the Hatleys claimed that following the airing of the Unsolved Mysteries episode, the strange supernatural occurrences had mostly come to a halt. However, they did say they were paid an unexpected visit by John's second wife, Victoria Mango Harden. Victoria had declined to participate in the Unsolved Mysteries segment, but told the Hatleys that she felt compelled to return to the house, as she hadn't been there since John was murdered. Victoria expressed her disappointment that John's spirit never paid a visit to her, so she was hoping to catch a glimpse of him at their former residence, but his ghost never appeared. Unfortunately, even though the Unsolved Mysteries episode wound up drawing the largest audience the show had ever seen up until that point, it failed to bring in any compelling new tips to law enforcement to assist them with the investigation into John's murder. In February of 2007, the case briefly reappeared in the spotlight when the Florida Department of Law Enforcement and the Lake County Sheriff's Office announced that they would be reopening the investigation as part of a cold case review. But unfortunately, the new investigation did not lead anywhere, and John's first wife, Rita Harden, passed away in November of 2011 at the age of 68. So after 47 years, there are no conclusive answers about who is responsible for the murder of John Harden. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Anyway, I will say that even though I rarely ever cover paranormal-related stories on The Trail Went Cold and stick mostly to true crime, I still have a fascination with the subject and have enjoyed many of the ghost segments featured on Unsolved Mysteries. But of course, in a lot of these stories, there isn't a lot to discuss or analyze other than, did so-and-so really see a ghost? However, I am fascinated by stories in which paranormal experiences actually do have a legitimate impact on real-life events. Of course, one of the most famous examples of this is a case which was also featured on Unsolved Mysteries, as well as an exclusive Patreon bonus episode of The Trail Went Cold, and that's the 1977 murder of Teresita Bassa. In case you're not familiar with it, this case wound up being solved when Teresita's spirit supposedly returned from the grave and possessed the body of one of her former co-workers in order to share information which led the police towards the killer, as well as evidence linking him to the crime. You can be skeptical of this story all you want, and believe that Teresita's co-worker completely fabricated her supposed ghostly possession, but the fact of the matter is that if she didn't provide investigators with this information, they may never have been able to solve this case. Of course, the John Harden murder doesn't quite fall into this category, because none of the alleged paranormal experiences from his former residence have helped the investigation in any way. However, the idea of a victim haunting the scene of his murder because his spirit cannot rest until he receives justice, is an intriguing hook for a ghost story, so you can understand why Unsolved Mysteries would have been compelled to produce a segment about this. I'm not sure it's a coincidence that the episode aired only 1 year following the release of the blockbuster film Ghost, which was the highest-grossing movie of 1990, and featured Patrick Swayze as a victim whose spirit remained trapped on Earth until he could help solve his own murder. Say what you will about the so-called hauntings in this story, but without them, I think there's a good chance that John Harden's murder might have faded into obscurity and no one would have heard of it. While I consider this to be one of my favorite paranormal segments on Unsolved Mysteries, I do have to admit that it kind of has a split personality between presenting a spooky story and trying to spread awareness about a cold case. In fact, I almost wish they had divided the segment up into two parts, one of which was focused on the hauntings, while the other had a much more in-depth exploration into the actual murder. You could argue that focusing on the supernatural aspects of the story might have been a disservice to John Harden's family, but his first wife, Rita, did agree to be interviewed for the segment. However, I'd be curious to know how that conversation went. Yeah, we're finally going to be bringing attention to your ex-husband's unsolved murder, but we're also going to explore the possibility that his ghost is haunting his former house. Hope you don't mind. Perhaps the weirdest paranormal aspect of this story is how June Ferris recounted having a recurring dream about walking down a staircase and exiting through the kitchen door, which resembled the route John Hardin would have taken when he ran outside his house and was shot to death. Assuming that June is not completely fabricating the story, it's pretty bizarre that she started having these dreams 7 years before the murder even took place while she was living in Virginia. It's also interesting how two separate groups of people who lived in the house, the Ferris family and Ken and Donna Hatley, shared very similar stories about their supernatural experiences, though I'd be curious to know if the Ferrises ever conversed with the Hatleys about this before they moved in. And I will acknowledge that this is one of the only Unsolved Mysteries ghost segments which mentioned that the production crew supposedly experienced unexplained paranormal events while they were filming on location. It's quite amusing to hear Robert Stack share this on camera, since he was known for being a major skeptic about many of the paranormal stories on the show. The Hatleys claimed that the haunting seemed to subside after the Unsolved Mysteries episode aired, though they did get featured in the Orlando Sentinel around Halloween in 1995. Even though the paranormal events were no longer as frequent, the Hatleys still felt compelled to call in some scientists and researchers from the Center for Paranormal Studies in Gainesville, who certified the house as being haunted. In fact, they reportedly snapped a photograph of a ghost, though I've never personally seen this photo, and I don't know if it has ever been released publicly. But it's worth mentioning that by 1995, Ken Hatley had become the project manager for Universal Studios' Halloween Horror Nights, so perhaps he was trying to drum up some extra publicity for his story. Anyway, here's the one reason I think that certain details about the story may have been exaggerated to fit the house that is haunted by a murder victim narrative. As you recall, multiple people reported seeing a ghostly figure of a man whom they believed was the spirit of John Hardin, which was supported by the fact that he appeared to be dressed in jeans and a flannel shirt, the same clothing that John was wearing when he was killed. However, I mentioned earlier that some of the original newspaper accounts of this story reported that since John noticed the burning pickup truck right after he emerged from the shower, he was still nude when he ran outside to extinguish the flames. In fact, they also mentioned that his wife Victoria was in the midst of running downstairs to bring John some clothes until he shouted at her to go grab the baby and get him out of the house safely. From what I can tell, the sources which report John throwing on a flannel shirt and jeans before he ran outside were not published until after the stories about the hauntings went mainstream. While I can't say for certain which version of this story is accurate, it would not surprise me at all if the detail about the flannel shirt and jeans might have been added retroactively in order to line up with the sightings of the ghost dressed in these same clothes. We could probably spend hours debating the legitimacy of these alleged hauntings, but I must reiterate that this is a true crime podcast, not a paranormal podcast, so for the rest of this episode, we're going to be focusing entirely on the details of John Hardin's murder. The Unsolved Mysteries segment contains a memorable quote from one of the investigators, Special Agent Bruce McMahon of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, who states, quote, "On a scale of 1 to 10 on difficulty of solving a crime, this is about as close to a 10 as I've ever seen," end quote. During my research, I was able to dig up some additional details about the crime, which do shed a little bit of extra light on certain things, but I still have a ton of unanswered questions. Obviously, law enforcement probably dug up a lot of information during their investigation, which they have never released publicly, as they said they did put together a list of several possible suspects, but there was no conclusive evidence to implicate any of them. I'm sure the first person you might be thinking of was John's wife, Victoria, because while I see no indication that she was considered a suspect, law enforcement never flat-out stated that she was cleared as a suspect, either. Since the Hardins' neighbors called the authorities and ran to the property after they saw the burning truck, I'm not sure Victoria would have had enough time to shoot John before they arrived, but since the shotgun was found in some bushes next to the house, I suppose it's not impossible that she would have been able to fire off one shot and quickly dump the weapon without anyone seeing anything. However, it's been reported that Victoria ran upstairs and grabbed her baby son, and likely still had the child in her arms when the neighbor showed up, in which case, it's very unlikely that she could have pulled this off. And while I can't confirm this, I'd like to think that investigators would have been able to perform a gunshot residue test on Victoria's hands to confirm if she fired a weapon or not. I did read one article that stated that Victoria was not cooperative with investigators following the murder, though they acknowledged that this may have been because they found some marijuana in the residence. So perhaps she was resistant to speak with police because of potential legal issues with drugs, rather than her having something to hide about her husband's death. All we really know about Victoria is that she moved back to Jacksonville, and even though she refused to participate in the Unsolved Mysteries episode in 1991, she did return to Claremont and paid a visit to the house after the show originally aired. I would be interested to know the current whereabouts of Victoria, as well as her son, John Warren Harden Jr., who was only 9 months old when he lost his father. Doing any research on that might be complicated, considering that John Sr. had two different sons with his respective families whom he named John Jr., which is just one of many unusual details surrounding this whole story. So now we have to talk about John's first wife, Rita Harden, whom he married right out of high school and had 4 children with. I see no indication that Rita was ever considered to be a suspect either, as she lived 170 miles away in Jacksonville, but I can understand why you might think she would have had a motive for this crime. Rita's Unsolved Mysteries interview was pretty surprising, to say the least, because she speaks so glowingly of John, calling him a quote-unquote good man, and painting him as a loving father to their children. I mean, I don't want to speak negatively about a murder victim, but the guy abandoned his own family, married a younger woman, had a child with her, and then moved to another town, so he does come across as pretty jerkish in this situation. The story Rita provided is that John just returned home from work one day and told her that he needed to go away for a while because he had some problems and needed to get himself together. But from my point of view, it almost seems like the guy was suffering from some sort of midlife crisis. I definitely believe there's a lot more to this story, and I have so many questions. Was John already conducting an affair with Victoria when he left his family, or did that start later? When did Rita become aware of John's new wife and the fact that they were having a child? Did John attempt to maintain a relationship with his other 4 children, or did he pretty much just cut them off when he moved to Claremont? Was he offering financial support to his family while he was gone? I will say, though, that if Rita had vengeance on her mind and wanted to go murder John for leaving her, I'm not sure she would wait a full year and a half in order to do so. I certainly would be curious to know if John was suffering from any legitimate personal problems when he left his family, as perhaps he felt that staying away from them would be the best way to protect them. No matter who was responsible, John's murder does come across as a very calculated crime, which almost resembles a professional hit, so you have to wonder who would have been motivated to do something like that to him. Now, I almost don't want to mention this next theory because of how absurd it is, but I felt I should bring it up because I've seen it mentioned in online discussions about this case. There's a website out there called Spook Hunters, which pushes forward a scenario of John's killer being his oldest son, Timothy. I mentioned earlier that only 4 days after the Unsolved Mysteries segment originally aired, Timothy died at the young age of 30, so it's been inferred that seeing his father's murder garner exposure on national television may have caused Timothy to become so overwhelmed with guilt that he took his own life. Another point which is used to support this theory is that the Hatleys claim that the hauntings at their house seem to die down after the Unsolved Mysteries episode aired. The logic seems to be that if Timothy was the killer, his death meant that John had finally received justice, so his restless spirit was no longer trapped in that house, and he could finally leave. Well, keep in mind that there are no official sources out there which list Timothy's exact cause of death, so we don't even know if it was a suicide. And of course, the big flaw in this theory is that Timothy would have only been 13 years old when his father was killed. Putting aside the believability of someone that young being able to obtain a shotgun, set fire to a truck, and cut a house's phone lines without being seen, Timothy was still living in Jacksonville at the time, so how exactly would he have made the 170-mile trip to Claremont? I really don't know if the timing of Timothy's death so soon after the Unsolved Mysteries episode is nothing more than a coincidence, but I seriously doubt he would have been able to pull off what essentially turned out to be the perfect crime at age 13. But of course, this only begs the question, who really did kill John Harden? Well, whoever the killer was, it's possible that they first arrived at the residence while John was out on the service call at the drive-in restaurant in Groveland, so they proceeded to cut the phone lines and hide out until John returned home before they set fire to the truck. Given the timing, you'd almost be inclined to think that this service call was a diversion to lure John away from the residence, but by all accounts, the call was legitimate, and I don't believe the restaurant owner was ever suspected of being involved. This did take place on a Saturday night, and I'm sure he desperately needed John to repair his broken chicken fryer to avoid losing too much potential business, so it was likely nothing more than a coincidence that this happened to take place on a night when someone showed up to commit murder. Admittedly, it is a bit odd that John decided to take his wife and baby son with him on a service call at that time of night, but they were described as being a tight-knit family unit, so perhaps this was just the sort of thing they did. I also learned that John actually had a part-time employee working for his refrigeration business at the time named David Ahern, who lived in Groveland. However, I don't have any further information about this guy, so I'm not sure if his whereabouts were accounted for that night, or if law enforcement ever considered him to be a possible suspect. Obviously, the killer set the pickup truck on fire for the express purpose of luring John out of the house to shoot him, and while this might sound like a professionally executed hit, the perpetrator still had to experience a lot of good luck in order to get away with it. It sounds like the fatal shot was fired a very short time before neighbors arrived to tend to the burning truck, and the killer managed to escape the scene undetected, but let's not forget that John came running out of the house after he emerged from the shower. If John had stayed in the shower just a few minutes longer, he probably wouldn't have even been aware that the truck was on fire, and the neighbors may have shown up before John ran outside, depriving the killer of an opportunity to shoot him. It's also strange that the killer would leave the shotgun behind, and they probably lucked out that investigators were unable to trace it. Law enforcement has also never publicly confirmed if there were any usable fingerprints on the weapon, but if they were, they obviously haven't been matched to anyone. So while there are some aspects of this crime which make it look like a professional hit, other details, such as the gun being left behind, give off the impression that the shooter may have been an amateur who had never committed a murder before. It doesn't sound like anyone reported seeing or hearing any vehicles fleeing the scene following the crime, which is why there was speculation that the killer may have gone to nearby Lake Mineola and left the area on a boat. Whatever the case, it's almost like they just seemed to vanish into thin air after shooting John. So it wasn't until I started reading old newspaper articles about this case when I finally learned about a potential motive I wasn't aware of before, and that's John's alleged troubles with labor unions. He reportedly made some enemies by refusing to join one particular union, and there was friction over the fact that his independent refrigeration business was picking up contracts which would cause union members to lose work. But would these issues have been serious enough to compel someone to commit murder? After all, it was reported that John had been having issues with labor unions in Jacksonville, so would anyone have traveled 170 miles to Claremont in order to kill him? There were also apparently rumors that Hardin was involved in drug trafficking, and while this was never substantiated, traces of marijuana were found inside his residence. Of course, this could have been nothing more than John and Victoria smoking weed recreationally, but theoretically, if John was using his refrigeration business as a cover for drug smuggling, there's a possible motive for this crime. The main reason I don't think it's unbelievable that John's business may not have been completely on the up and up is because he named it Mango Refrigeration after his wife's maiden name, and he apparently introduced himself to some people as John Mango. What logical reason would he have for doing that? We also have these claims from law enforcement about how none of John's friends wanted to admit they were friends with him following his murder and tried to pass themselves off as nothing more than casual acquaintances. And according to one of the detectives, some of these people had shaky alibis on the night of the crime. So could any of them have been complicit in John's death, or at the very least, knew more than they were letting on? Were they trying to downplay their friendships with John because they were involved in killing him? Or were they just involved in other illegal activities? Or did they just fear for their own lives? While law enforcement has never named anyone as the suspect or person of interest, they did say they had several possible suspects, so it seems like there might be certain people they never completely ruled out. If you read between the lines, this may be one of those cases where investigators have a few bits and pieces of the puzzle, but not enough to connect everything together. In spite of the whole haunted house angle on Unsolved Mysteries, I'm sure investigators were quite happy to get this case some exposure on national television, but unfortunately, it does not sound like it brought in any new major tips. For all we know, the only person who knows what happened is the individual who pulled the trigger, and if they have managed to keep their mouth shut, then the case would be difficult to solve. So yeah, with the information we have right now, I couldn't even begin to tell you who is responsible for this crime and what their motive could have been. Given the number of years that have passed, it's possible that the killer is dead by now, but I would sure love to know if they were able to watch the Unsolved Mysteries segment when it originally aired back in 1991. It must be a weird feeling to see your crime featured on national television, only it's surrounded by speculation that the victim's ghost returned from the grave to haunt his former residence because he never received justice. However, I have to put aside this supernatural stuff and remind everyone that John Harden was a real person who suffered a violent, tragic death, leaving behind a number of people who loved him and never received answers about what happened. Instead of relying on ghost sightings, the best way to solve this case is for someone with information to finally come forward. So if by chance you happen to have any information about the unsolved murder of John Harden, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a bonus episode about an odd case from Unsolved Mysteries, the story of Dan Tondevold, a mysterious con artist who swindled a wealthy socialite out of her fortune before he supposedly killed himself in what may have been an attempt to fake his own death. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss yet another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1971 murder of an unidentified Jane Doe known as Little Miss Panasofsky. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Brian M., Toaster Bunny, and the Ghosts of Vegas Past podcast. Thank you all so much for your support. Anyway, I wanted to mention that in just over a week from now, we are going to be holding our next Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch on Saturday, October the 22nd at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, in which we screen classic segments from the show, and you can watch them and leave comments with myself and your fellow listeners. And of course, since Halloween is just around the corner, this particular live watch is going to feature a number of supernatural-themed segments from Unsolved Mysteries, including today's featured case about the John Harden murder and the subsequent hauntings of his house. You can find the link to our screening room in our show notes, and it will also be pinned to the top of our social media pages. So once again, our next Unsolved Mysteries live watch takes place in just over a week on Saturday, October the 22nd at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and we hope to see you there. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. And you might have noticed that we brought back the spookier version of his Trail Went Cold theme this month for our Halloween episodes. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new Halloween-themed episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶